Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 002 of the podcast. Today's guest is performance coach Alan Stein Jr. Now, I've known Alan for a very long time, and not only is he just a great guy, but I'm thrilled to have him on the show because I believe his story and passion will provide a great value to you and also inspire you to do some great things. So in this episode, we discussed Alan's time as a sports performance coach, training athletes like NBA champion Kevin Durant and number one draft pick Markelle Fultz. Alan discusses how he's currently applying his years of experience on the court to the business world as a corporate performance coach. We detail the importance of morning routines and how being of service put him at the table with Gary Vaynerchuk, Mark Cuban, and Jesse Itzler. All right, sit back, relax, and please enjoy our conversation. All right, Alan. How's it going, man?
I'm great. Are we already recording?
We are recording.
Sweet.
Everywhere. It's time for rapid fire questions.
Fire away.
Dogs or cats?
I grew up with cats.
So you're sticking with cats?
Actually, I prefer neither. I'm not a big pets guy. I have three kids, which are my three monkeys. That's good enough.
You can't, you're on the road all the time.
That's
you
true.
Can't
yeah.
Feed anything.
Yeah, that's very true.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars.
Rolling Stones or Beatles?
Rolling Stones.
Coke or Pepsi?
Coke. I'm not a big soda guy, but if I had to pick one, I'll go Coke. I like their branding better.
So it's a branding thing.
Yeah, and I don't drink either.
You're wearing a red shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Beach or mountains?
Oh, beach by far.
PC or Mac?
I do Apple everything.
East or West Coast?
Oh, I mean, born and raised on the East Coast, probably not going anywhere till my kids grow up, but I love the West Coast. If family was not an issue, I'd move out west in a heartbeat.
Kramer or Costanza?
Oh, I'm going to give Kramer the nod, but I'm a Seinfeld aficionado, love everything about that show. And each episode, I think I have a different favorite character, but I'll give Kramer the nod.
What's your favorite episode?
Oh, gosh. The sweet spot, the first couple seasons, I think they were still trying to get their bearings. Yeah. And the last couple seasons, I felt like they were trying a little bit too hard. They had already run out of all their good ideas. But that sweet spot of the middle five or six seasons, that'd be like asking me to pick my favorite child. They were all amazing.
So everybody picks the obvious, the competition.
Yeah.
My favorite is the one where Kramer was hitting golf balls into the ocean, and then it landed in a dolphin or a whale, and then George went out and got
it.
Something about that episode I love. It's
brilliant.
My favorite.
There was another one where Kramer hired an intern, which was absolutely
Darren?
Brilliant. Yes. Kramerica's.
Kramerica. Let's watch that now and turn on the background. Superman or Batman?
Superman.
Who do you think would win? Superman?
I feel like Superman would.
All right. Last one. Kardashians or Osbournes?
Neither. I'll politely refrain from either.
All right. Thanks for coming in.
No, my pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to see you.
All right. So you're known as a performance coach. What does that mean?
As it would sound, I help folks improve their performance, which for most of my career has been in the basketball space, which means I help players improve their athleticism, their ability to move on the court, their movement efficiency, and basically took care of every aspect except for the skilled portion. So I never taught players how to shoot or how to dribble, but taught them how to take control of their bodies, how to eat well, how to get proper rest and recovery, just so they could increase their ability to perform their skills. And then I've recently transitioned to the corporate space where now I help entrepreneurs, CEOs, leaders improve their performance, which quite interestingly uses many of the exact same skill sets, routines, habits, and mindsets that athletes need.
Well, how did you get started? Were you an athlete?
I was. Basketball has always been my number one passion. As a child, I played and did everything you could possibly think of, from skateboarding and BMX biking to martial arts to your conventional team sports of football, soccer, basketball, baseball. But I always kept going back to basketball. That was my first love. Now, I'm 41 years old, so I'm growing up in the, primarily in the 80s, which is when Michael Jordan kind of took over the NBA. And I think like many people in my age bracket, he was the one that just made basketball an unparalleled sport to want to be a part of. And, that's definitely what I kept going back to. I was fortunate enough to play in college. It was Elon College at the time. They're now Elon University down in North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
And around the time of going into college, I started to have an equal affinity for performance training, getting stronger, getting in the weight room, running sprints, trying to improve my vertical jump. I mean, what 6 foot white suburbanite kid did not want to dunk a basketball? I mean, that was my number one goal in life, was to be able to dunk. So I started really getting interested in that domain and figuring out how I could run faster and jump higher. So when I graduated college, it was just a natural transition for me to go from my love of basketball combined with my love of performance work and become a quote unquote strength and conditioning coach.
Well, when you grew up in near DC, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I originally thought I wanted to be a teacher and a basketball coach. Both of my parents were in elementary education for 30 years, and I figured in order to be a high school basketball coach, really the primary vocation would be a teacher.
Yeah.
Yet I was not very passionate about the teaching portion. There wasn't any specific subject or any grade that I really wanted to do, and realized one thing I learned from my parents, you know, teaching is a vocation. You have to be all in. I mean, you're literally molding the youth of America. So it's not something you can just punch a clock or mail in. Your heart has to be in it. And The moment I realized my heart wasn't in it, I needed to pivot and figure something else out.
It sounds like, though, you pivoted into a different type of teaching.
Yes. Oh, and that's the thing. As a coach, I'll always consider myself a teacher first. Yeah. I just wasn't passionate about conventional teaching in a school setting, teaching a curriculum and so
geography.
Forth. But yeah, exactly.
So when we met, you were doing strength and conditioning. What does that mean? Run faster, jump higher?
Yep. Improve athleticism. So that it's neat because originally strength and conditioning coach was how I referred to myself. But then I wanted to expand the title because we did so much more than just get players strong and just get them in good condition. Those were only two of the pillars of what we're trying to do. You know, we address flexibility and agility and mobility, all of the illities, if you will. And just saying strength and conditioning coach was an incomplete title. So that was why we changed it to performance coach. Because we're responsible for every aspect of performance outside of skill.
So that wasn't in the top of your mind when you were doing prior to college sports. You were just like everybody else is playing sports.
Yes.
And then dealing with what you had.
Yeah.
You know,
but there was something in sports that I always gravitated towards. I mean, one, it was the idea of teamwork and team cohesion and the camaraderie you'd have with other players. And I always enjoyed that. I was one link on the chain that I worked hard to improve myself, but I needed to work equally hard to improve those around me so that the entire team could be better. And there was something about that that always fascinated me. So ever since I was young, you know, the concepts of leadership and teamwork, and even though I didn't use that terminology when I was a kid, building a culture of excellence has always been something that's interested me.
But our generation, we didn't have companies like yours, and we'll get into that, but we didn't, your talent was your talent, and the coaches would massage that and help you get better and improve that and put you in right schemes and stuff. But there was no strength and conditioning coaches for high school or, you know, going into collegiate programs, was there?
Not really. I mean, football was the first, and they've always been kind of the pioneers on the performance side. Yeah. But basketball, no. I mean, so I graduated college in 98, and in 1998, less than a third of NBA teams had even a strength and conditioning consultant at
that
point. And those that did, most of those consultants were bodybuilders, were Olympic lifters, were guys that just quote unquote looked like they knew what they were doing. So you can see fast forward, you know, 25 years where we are today. Not only does every NBA team have a strength and conditioning coach, they have an entire staff dedicated to performance. Mm-hmm. They have massage therapists, they have nutritionists, they have physical therapists, they have a strength and conditioning and performance coach who also has an assistant. I mean, they do yoga, they do Pilates.
Cryotubs.
Absolutely. I mean, so they went from not a non-existent position to an entire division on their staff, you know, in the last 20, 25 years.
So what was it in college that kind of lit that light bulb in your head of, wait a minute, I can actually get, I can run faster, I can jump? Like, was there a person that introduced this philosophy to you?
John Philbin is a local DC guy, and he was an assistant strength coach with the Redskins. He was a strength coach with the Nationals. I mean, he's been extremely influential, especially in the early part of my career. Mm-hmm. And when I was preparing to play at Elon, this was after my senior year, he noticed me in the gym. He had a gym in the area and would notice that I was following bodybuilding workouts. I mean, literally, I'm carrying a Muscle and Fitness magazine around with me. Now, remember, this is pre-internet. This is before there was really viable information. So at the time, that was the best that I thought was available.
Did you want to get big and thick?
Not necessarily. I just knew I wanted to be stronger because I knew that if I was stronger, then I could run faster and jump higher. It's the equivalent of putting a bigger engine in your car. And there was just no other resources. And I think he took a liking to me because I was inconsistently and I was always working really hard. And one day he pulled me aside and said, look, I'd love to show you a few things, but I need you to have an open mind because everything I'm going to show you is almost 180 degrees different than what you've been reading. But I can promise you, you'll get better results. They'll be more applicable to what you're trying to do as an athlete, and it'll take you a fraction of the time. Are you interested? And I'm very thankful that I was interested. I mean, it sounds obvious now, but I don't know if you knew this. When I was in my teens and my 20s, I knew everything. So it was, I really didn't need counsel from anyone because I already had all the answers. But for some reason, I said, sure. And he said, look, just give me the summer. Do exactly what I say for this summer. Train with me. And if you don't like where you are at the end of summer, then, you know, forget that we ever did this. And I did. And I got amazing results in a fraction of the time. And absolutely fell in love with his methodology, which was called HIIT, high intensity training, which is brief and frequent training. And ever since, that has made up the foundation of my beliefs as a performance coach.
So is that not doing so many sets and reps? It's just push the weight as much as you can, not quickly, but...
For the most part, it's usually one set, one or two sets, the absolute momentary muscular fatigue to the point where you cannot do another repetition and you work your full body equally. You only do that 2 to 3 times a week. So you come in and work your entire body for 45, 50 minutes as intensely as possible, very brief and limited number of sets. And then you take one or two days off and you do that again.
So there's no like upper body day, lower body day?
Not with that philosophy. Okay. And again, that's if we're going to completely generalize it. There are some, you know, some offshoots of that. But yeah, it was basically 3 full body workouts a week. Now that was just the strength portion. I was doing conditioning work and on the track and in the gym. But just the strength side, you know, I was doing bodybuilding workouts, which for the most part would be come in on Monday and just do your chest and spend 90 minutes on one body part, irregardless of the fact that that one body part's not even that needed in the game of basketball. So I'm spending 90 minutes on something that's borderline irrelevant to my needs as a player. And then the next day I'd come in and just do my back. And then the next day, so you're talking about 6 workouts a week for 90 minutes. And he was able to do that in 3 45-minute workouts and get a better result.
Were you reluctant initially when he came up to him?
I was just initially because I'm thinking, well, you're just some mere mortal in front of me and I'm holding a magazine. So if it's in a magazine, it has to be true. And of course, I'm so naive that I didn't realize all the pharmaceutical enhancements that many of the folks that donned Muscle and Fitness were partaking in. But I believed him. And one thing I realized is his level of training, it was so hard from an intensity standpoint. I mean, it was absolutely brutal, which was neat because a lot of people think that by doing less work, it would be easier, but it was absolutely the opposite. When you do less work, you can raise the intensity level tenfold because the body can either work hard or it can work long. It can't do both, which is why you can run 100 yards or any human being can run 100 yards much faster than you can run a marathon. You can't expect the body to run at that speed for a much longer distance. So it was the same thing. If you're only coming in for 45 minutes, you're going to absolutely lay the wood on every set of every rep. And I like that. I like that mindset.
I call that the shovel principle. My grandfather had this estate and it was on a big hill. And there was, I would probably say, about 200-yard driveway up a hill. And he would asphalt it, but just with the rain and the wear and tear, it would fall apart. So he just like, screw it. Let's do bluestone. So every other year, I would go over there and he would have a ginormous mound of bluestone delivered to the top of the hill. And then during the summer, I would help him, you know, spread that out throughout the whole driveway. And I thought I was doing it easier when just not filling the shovel up, because it was harder to fill a full shovel up. And I thought I was getting off easy. And he stopped me one time and he was like, listen, if you keep doing that, A, it's going to take you 10 times as long and you're going to be more tired and, you know, it's not worth it. It's not your best. So fill up that shovel all the way. It might feel difficult, more difficult than doing a half shovel, but you're doing it the right way. It's going to be done faster and your body's going to thank you as well. So that's a lesson I try to apply to the kids all the time, my kids, that, you know, just use a full shovel.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's what that principle is.
All based on intensity. Yeah.
I worked out with your company that we'll talk about, and that was the first workout that I did. I wanted to throw up because it was hard.
Yeah, very hard.
Very hard. So was that in college when you met?
Yes, Phil? That was right. Yes. So I trained with him after my senior year of high school to get ready for Elon. And I can say without question, it was the best shape that I've ever been of in my entire life. And I'm a fairly fit person and I've been fit most of my life, but without question, entering my freshman year of college was the best shape I'd ever been in.
When you went to college and when you're on the basketball team, did they look at you like you had two heads with this regimen? Because they probably didn't know anything like
no,
this.
It was definitely different than what they were used to, which was neat. But again, we didn't even have a performance coach at Elon when I got there. No, gosh, no. I mean, we had an assistant coach that would open up the weight room if some folks wanted to get in there, but it wasn't anything like it is today. I know. It makes it sound like I'm 90 years old talking about it wasn't that long ago. So they were actually pretty cool with me doing whatever I wanted to do because they figured, well, him doing something is better than him doing nothing. So whatever. But yes, for some of the other guys on the team that were also interested, it was very counterculture to what they were doing. When the football coach was in there and the football players had to come in, it was very counterculture to what they were doing. So it did raise some eyebrows. But also at this time, I mean, you're talking late 90s now. Mm-hmm. This is when, I mean, the internet really started to pick up. And granted, there weren't the plethora of sites there are today.
Yeah.
There were some sites dedicated to high intensity training that had a series of coaches that would write articles and blogs. I mean, barely pictures back in that day. It's all text. But I was devouring this stuff. So I stopped picking up muscle and fitness and started reading what actual college performance coaches. There was a guy named Ken Manny, who was the football performance coach at Michigan State. And he was a big advocate of the HIIT training. Dan Riley was the head strength and conditioning coach for the Redskins. He was a big advocate of it. There was four or five names, and I was devouring everything that those guys wrote. And it just made sense. It just seemed to click to me. It made logical sense. I'm not an extremely creative person. My brain works very linear and it's very practical and logical. And the stuff they were saying makes sense, which is if you can achieve the same result in one set as you do in three, why would you need to do two extra sets? And if you make the intensity high enough in the first one, you don't need to do the next two sets. That just made sense to me. I mean, there's people that will argue that and that's fine. But to me, that just clicked. And I've been kind of under that high intensity principle ever since.
So what did you do after you graduated college?
I moved back to this area. There was a guy here that was actually a personal trainer for several NBA players. And that was what I wanted to do. So I came back and worked for him for about 6 months and didn't really agree with not only his training style, but I didn't really agree with the way that he ran his business. And I'll just leave it at that. And just decided at that point, I'd rather just do my own thing. And that was when I've basically been self-employed and been an entrepreneur my entire adult life outside of that real brief stint where I was an independent contractor underneath him.
What do you remember? What players?
Most of the players that came out of Georgetown. So he had a chance to work with Patrick Ewing. Mm. He had a chance to work with Alonzo Mourning, Dikembe Mutombo, some really high profile players. Yeah. And this was the other thing that I learned from that lesson, that it was all about relationships. He was friends with the agent for those players. So he was given those players, not because of his training acumen, because of a personal relationship. And that's fine. I don't hold that against him. I mean, I've been able to benefit in many ways in my life based on relationships I've had. But I love that because it taught me a lesson. It taught me that relationships are extremely important. You want to be good at your craft, but at the end of the day, you could be the best performance coach in the world and still not get any business if you don't have relationships with influential people. So immediately I learned that not only working on my craft was important, but developing relationships and quote unquote networking was also important if you're going to be in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. So after you left him, what'd you do?
Then a mutual friend that you and I had, Jason Hadid, was running a company called Elite Athlete Training Systems that he had started about a year or two before. And it was just him at the time. He took notice to what I was doing in the gym and basically said, why don't you be my partner? Let's run this thing together and let's offer professional grade training at an affordable rate for high school kids in the Montgomery County area. And yeah, then Jason and I partnered up and we're partners for a while. I mean, probably seven or 8 years. That was exactly when we met.
So you guys would, so to clarify or to make it, you guys would take kids that weren't in high school to get them in good high school programs?
We had some middle school players. Okay. Yeah, but we didn't go much younger than that at the time.
Okay.
It was, I would say our average player at the time was a junior or senior in high school. Over the 5 or 6 years that Jason and I were together, that age, that average age lowered. Probably most kids started in middle school.
Okay. Because it became important to get into the Montrose Christians and the DeMatha basketball programs. And
yes.
The football programs. But a big focus of that was to get those high school kids into really good, get them fit enough to get them into really good college programs, right?
For sure. That was a primary motivator. Yeah. I mean, you know, a good portion of kids that play high school have the dreams of playing a college sport. Not all. I mean, some are happy just playing in high school. They do it more for social reasons, to be a part of something. But your more serious players hope that that's a springboard to play in college. And if they wanted to play in college, they realized that at the time, this was a major separator, that improving their performance in strength and conditioning and athleticism was necessary for them to be able to play at that next level.
What's that like to see these kids and know them as high schoolers, but then they get into really good programs and end up in the pros?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I mean, the two programs you mentioned, Montrose Christian and DeMatha, I was able to be a part of. And I think between the two, we maybe had a dozen players end up in the NBA. It's just neat because you get in on the ground level and you meet a young man where he's got the whole world in front of him. He's full of potential. And then to, over time, see that potential actualize and him achieve a dream of playing in college and then going on and getting paid to play is really neat. And it's also a neat metamorphosis because not only did they improve physically and on the court, but they grew emotionally and mentally as well. I mean, I use Kevin Durant as an example all the time. I mean, when I first met Kevin, he wouldn't say three words. Very introverted, very shy, very quiet. And now, I mean, he's in national commercials. He holds press conferences. So to see his growth and how he's able to deal, on an emotional and mental level is just as awesome as seeing what he does on the court.
That's so funny because you and I were filming Kevin at Montrose one day. And I remember being in the weight room, pulled you aside, and I said, this guy's not going to the pros. He's too skinny.
Mm-hmm.
And you looked at me and laughed, and everybody else did. I just didn't see it.
Yeah. And that's probably a fair assessment. I mean, I think most people that knew basketball knew at the time he was going to be a pretty good player, but I don't think anyone knew he was going to be one of the top three players in the world at that time.
Yeah.
But that just shows.
I mean, he was quiet and skinny and just, you didn't see that. I didn't see the few times I was around him, like that fire, you know?
Yeah.
But I was wrong.
Yeah, and that's okay. And as were a lot of people, but that's pretty neat that he was able to come full circle and do those things.
Okay, so when you and Jason were working together, it kind of naturally worked out where you focused on basketball, Jason focused on football, and then you went off and started Stronger Team.
Yes.
Was that scary to go off on your...
It wasn't too bad. No. I mean, and you just hit it on the head. I mean, we were running a company that was going to serve athletes of all sports. But for me, almost selfishly, I just had such more of an interest in basketball that it wasn't fair for me to be the co-owner of a company when my interest was very narrow. So we amicably split, and I basically said, I'm just going to focus on basketball. And at that point, I mean, I think we maybe had 30 independent trainer, working for us, independent contractors, mm-hmm. Built it up to a really nice business. And Jason was fine running it as it was, and I chose to focus on Stronger Team. Having been kind of self-employed my entire life, I didn't really see it as that risky, and I wasn't that worried about it because I was immune to it. I think if you work in a quote unquote conventional job, a 9-to-5, where you've got steady pay and you do that for 20 years and then you go out on your own,
right.
I imagine it's much scarier. For me, I didn't know any different, and I had built enough of a basketball clientele and basketball relationships that I was able to kind of jumpstart that. I had a little bit of a head start with that business.
Did you do anything differently?
I did a lot of things differently, but my whole model was I didn't want to just be in the gym myself training players. I wanted to make a much bigger impact on youth basketball. So while I needed to do that to pay my bills, as soon as I could get out on the speaking circuit and start speaking at basketball clinics around the world, as soon as I could start to travel and run large camps and clinics where I'm working with hundreds of kids instead of a couple of kids, I knew I wanted to make that mm-hmm. pivot because that the only way I could scale my message and reach more players was to get out of the four walls in the gym of Rockville, Maryland. So that was definitely a mind shift, and it served me well. I mean, I got to travel. I got to be a part of some really cool events.
Yeah, so tell me about some of these events. I mean, who are some of these NBA guys that I've seen pictures of you at their camps?
Well, here's where I was very fortunate. You know, if you read Outliers, the book Outliers,
not.
Okay, so one of the main premise of Outliers is it's not only important to be good at what you do, but you have to be good at what you do at the right time. Mm. And it talks about the one of the reasons the Beatles were so successful was because of the time that they entered the music industry. One of the reasons Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were successful because they were the perfect age when they were coming up. Had they been much older, the internet craze would have passed them. If they would have been much younger, they'd have been too novice to have been able to make a contribution. So they were the perfect age. So certainly not comparing myself to Steve Jobs, but I was at the perfect age to be in basketball performance where I had built up enough of a resume that I was credible, but there weren't very many other people doing it. So I was able to reach out to all of these different clinics and say, look, if you'd like to add this new cutting edge dynamic to your clinic and have someone come in and talk about performance and athleticism, I'd love to do it. But I didn't have any competition. No one else was asking them. So it was very low risk on their end. So I was able to talk my way into some really cool situations, some things with Nike and with Jordan Brand and with USA Basketball. And I mean, I've spoken at clinics all over the world. I mean, in Europe and South America, but a lot of it was because I was getting in at the right time. Mm. Right now, every one of those events is fully saturated. You know, if I walked outside and got hit by a bus, they could replace me in 2 seconds. That's how many people are doing this. So I'll never, you know, I always want to make sure I pay homage to the fact that it was a good time. But once I got in, I still had to convince people that this stuff was important. That was the part that made it more difficult. Why wasn't everyone else doing this? This was something that was new, but I relished in that opportunity, enjoyed it. And the camps you mentioned, I was able to be a part of the Nike Skills Academies, which started in 2007. And they took headlining players, Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, Vince Carter, LeBron James, and they would build camps around them. And I was able to work those camps, which gave me insight and access to learning from those guys and finding out what they did during the unseen hours. And that's a good portion of what I use to teach others.
What surprised you most about those experiences with those guys?
That the stuff they were doing was very basic. They
really?
Weren't there. They weren't doing anything magical behind the scenes. You know, the stuff Kobe Bryant would do in his private workouts was very basic, but don't believe that being basic and being easy, they're not synonyms. Just because something's basic in theory doesn't mean that it's easy to do. So the stuff they would do, I mean, they were relentless in their pursuit of development and growth, but they never got bored with the basics. They realized that the fundamentals were going to be what would make them great. So to see guys like that, they are absolutely committed to the fundamentals, and their level of consistency is incredible. You know, where most people want to skip over the basics and look for what's hot and sexy and what's new, those guys stay committed to the basics.
Well, these clinics were about how to be better basketball players.
The clinics as a whole were, yes. And I would just take the niche of performance. So here's the way we always looked at it. If you were building a pyramid, the base level of the pyramid would be performance. It would be the body. It'd be how your body moves. The next level up would be your skill. Can you shoot, pass, rebound, defend, and handle the ball? The next level up would be your brain. Do you understand how to play the game? Do you have a basketball IQ? Do you have mental toughness? And then the top of the pyramid is your heart. That's your grit, your motor. How bad do you want it? So you actually need all four levels for a player to be successful. But mine was always the base level to which the house was built. And I took a lot of pride in that.
Did you find that those players kind of took heed of that? They practiced the strength and conditioning as well. That was important to them.
It was just starting at that time. And one of the best things to happen, there's a gentleman named Tim Grover, who I give a lot of credit to, who was Michael Jordan's trainer, Kobe's trainer. And, you know, anytime you can get the best player in the world, Michael Jordan, to buy into something, it makes it a lot easier for the other dominoes to fall. So Michael Jordan has always been into lifting weights. Now, of course, what he was doing in the 80s and 90s, you know, is a far cry from what players today are doing, but that's just because of advancement.
Intellectual science involved now.
Exactly, which is tremendous. But few would argue that LeBron James is the best player in the game today, and LeBron does all of this stuff. He is so cutting edge from, you know, cryotherapy and ice baths to massage to Pilates to yoga to, I mean, it's amazing. So when the best player in the world fully buys in and believes in to a certain methodology, it just makes it easier for everybody
else. Pushes the movement.
Yeah.
What role does diet play in all this? Was that ever a part of a the huge conversation?
One. Oh, it had to be, without question. Now, for me, since I'm not a nutritionist or a registered dietitian, there are laws on how much information right. I can share on that. So I could never tell a player what to eat or when to eat it. I could just provide some general guidelines. But yes, what you eat and when you eat it has a huge effect on how you look, how you feel, and how you perform, which are three things that are important to most basketball players on some level. And that's the fuel. So if you want to be able to perform at a high level continuously and consistently, then you have to eat well. And that is without question the biggest Achilles heel for most younger players, middle school and high school. Yeah. I mean, I joke about how, you know, Kevin, I mean, his diet in high school was atrocious. Now, respectfully, some of that was due to he came from a background socioeconomically that, you know, wasn't able to go to Whole Foods and eat.
Yeah, but you know what a lot of that was? I remember when we would go on bus trips, you know, after a big game, after any game, they would drive us to McDonald's.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and pull the bus up and we'd get out and we thought that was great.
Yeah. And a lot of it was just from lack of information. Yeah. A lot of people didn't know that there was something better out there for players. But, you know, I mean, I would tell Kevin all the time, because Kevin, as you mentioned, was rather slight of frame and needed to gain weight. And I would tell him, if you eat like a bird, you look like a bird. Like, you need to eat more if you'd like to gain weight. And he did that, and it was tough for him. And then he did that at Texas. And, you know, one of the things I'm most proud about Kevin is one of the first purchases he made when he was a pro and he got his money was not a new watch or a necklace or a house. He actually hired a full-time chef because he knew that's how important it was to him being in the NBA and staying in the NBA and performing at a high level. So I thought that was fantastic that he kind of put his money where his mouth is, you know, pun intended.
Well, I think a lot of that's education as well.
Oh, for sure.
The information that they get, or the I hate to say handlers, but, you know, the teams put handlers on these guys.
Yeah.
Like the Kwame Brown, for those who don't know, number one overall pick in the Jordan era of the Wizards. Mm-hmm. He would go home and eat, you know, chicken and hamburgers and before games.
And then wonder why he's not performing at a high level.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we talk about all of the crossover and transfer from sport to business, it's the same now in business. I mean, if you're a high-powered CEO and you're expected to be on for hours on day and you have to be high energy and you're traveling and you're doing all this, you need to eat well. I mean, this stuff is extremely important. I mean, you might not have to jump out of the gym and maybe your aesthetics aren't as important to you if you're in a three-piece suit all day, but for you to have the sustained energy to influence and impact and lead everyone in your company, what you eat is extremely important.
Well, it seems now that these athletes are more in tune with the big picture.
Yes.
So like even a Kwame Brown, his eating habits were related to his just life habits, because at the time, he didn't know how to do his laundry. Mm-hmm. The coaches would show up at his house because he was late because he didn't change any of his alarms. And there's piles and piles of clothes everywhere because he just didn't. You know, nowadays, the younger players are taught. I think they have programs now, rookie, you know, training protocols of this is what life is like. And if you want to be in this field for that long, you know.
And to teach them how to be pros.
Yeah.
You know, for most of the players I've talked with, when they go from college to pro, the basketball portion is the easiest acclimation that they have to make. Easiest by far, the on the court stuff. It's learning how to do all of the little things that they might not have learned how to do on their own. And I can certainly empathize with them on that.
So during the Stronger Team era of your career, you started to focus on media, getting yourself out there, recording a lot of these things. What was the background behind that?
I was very fortunate that I, at least in the training space, I was one of the earlier adopters to use social media to share my business. And really, it was only because I was dealing with high school kids all of the time. I mean, I remember vividly being at Montrose and kids telling me what Twitter was and trying to explain it. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then I had been a subscriber to Fast Company, Inc., Entrepreneur, a handful of those magazines. And I started to notice that, you know, Twitter and YouTube and different social platforms were being heavily featured, not just in the magazine, on the cover. And I was like, okay, there's something here. Mm-hmm. The folks on the business side are saying how important this is. And the young people that I see every day are telling me that it's cool, that it's hip. So that was when I started to take notice. And I started to read up and study on what these platforms could do and basically learn that they could be a megaphone for me to promote my business and promote what I was doing with people that I might not meet otherwise. And I knew that, you know, my goal was to share as much quality training information as possible. So I'm already traveling around the world to go share this information via clinics. Why would I not want to share it digitally? Mm. Why would I not want to take, and I had the little flip camera, mm-hmm. why would I not want to take a video of me with a flip camera and upload that so other people could see it? If nothing else, it would help coaches and players better themselves, which was always my goal, my altruistic goal. And it would attract people to me because people would say, wait a second, what is this guy doing in this exercise? Maybe we need to bring him in for a clinic. So it served two purposes. And then the third purpose was not only could I share, I could learn from other people, but then I started to engage. Someone would send me an reply on Twitter mm-hmm. and just say, hey, I really like that exercise. Can you tell me more about it? And now I'm interacting with people in the same way you would with a text message, except I've never met them before. And I found that really neat. So that sweet spot of 2009, 10, 11. I mean, I was all in on social. And I mean, looking back on it, obviously I did a lot of things wrong. I mean, I was learning, you know, as I went. But I'm so happy that I was one of the earlier adopters of it in that industry.
The communicating back, is that where a lot of people drop the ball? They just think if they post this information that it's going to have legs.
But I think that's where people drop the ball now, for sure. I think social media is designed to engage, and it's, yeah, that's the purpose now. And I use it for those same three reasons. One, I put out stuff now consistently because I want to share. If I learn something new, it doesn't do me any good to keep it to myself. I want to share it with other people. And I've always believed that a candle loses nothing by lighting another candle. So even if you're considered my competitor, if I share with you something that helps better the game and better your clients, that doesn't make me any worse off. In fact, that shows that I'm confident enough to share my stuff. So the sharing is crucial. I use it to learn. I mean, I'm always following the thought leaders of any industry so that I can learn from them. It's kind of a temporary mentorship, if you will, that when you follow somebody, you know, like now, like a Gary Vaynerchuk, mm-hmm. You know, very established entrepreneur and business person. I mean, I devour his stuff because it's a way to learn from him. And then yes, the engagement is extremely important.
Hey, you did something with him, right?
I have. I've done an interview with him, and how'd most that of that happen? Was spawned through social media.
I so mean, did you
social
reach
media
out
is
to
the
him?
Social media is the great connector,
which is
neat. And it's also, you know, now obviously there's a time investment for social media, but there's not necessarily a financial investment if you're handling everything on your own. So I always looked at it as a great equalizer. There could be a big training company that makes millions of dollars, has 50 trainers on staff, but I'm capable of putting out just as much content as they are if I'm willing to be consistent with it. And so I found that was really helpful.
I'm going to go back to the Gary thing, but sure. You just mentioned there's a time commitment. How do you balance that? How do you schedule that? Do you use third-party scheduling apps to get your stuff out there, or are you doing it in the moment?
No, it's a little bit of both. And my brother Jeremy actually is kind of my social media director now. So I'm responsible for every piece of content. Every word that goes on any platform originally comes from me. Now, if I wasn't the creator of it, I was the curator of it. I gathered that information, and then I funnel that over to my brother, who then cleans it up. He's a graphic designer. Mm-hmm. He's the one that actually creates the physical memes or the videos. And then we use a scheduler to post that. Anytime there's ever any type of response, that always comes from me personally.
So you're looking at it every day yourself.
Yes. Again, and more for the engagement. Now, for me, because my time is valuable, I'm a parent, I'm a business owner, you know, I've had to put some parameters on so that I'm not on my phone tethered to it 24/7 looking at it. But yes, I definitely check into social media. I do my best not to check it an hour before I go to sleep. Obviously, I'm not checking it while I'm asleep. And I do my best not to check it for the first hour when I awake. Anytime throughout the day. Now, if I'm engaged in some purposeful work, I'm writing an article or I'm working on a talk, then I keep my notifications off and I don't look at it. But in between things, I'm checking it fairly regularly. Same way with email.
You've told me before why you don't check it in the morning. Tell everybody why that is.
Primarily just to set my mood. I don't believe in giving other people power over me. And I found that more times than not, if I'm looking at social media or emails or text messages, that whatever's coming in, it has an effect on my mood. Now, I'm not saying that it should, but it does. And I don't believe in starting my day by putting the control of my mood in somebody else's hands. So I just ignore it until I've meditated in the morning, maybe gotten in a workout, eaten breakfast, done a little bit of purposeful work where my mind is much more foundational, that if I do receive a piece of news now, it's going to have much less of effect on me.
Well, you told me once that, okay, if I get a bad email, like I lost an account or did this or did that, that's going to put me in a bad mood right away.
For sure.
But even if it's a good email,
but it's still risky. And now I'm an optimist and I'm extremely positive. And I would say, generally speaking, most of the people that I come in contact with are very supportive. They treat me really well. I mean, I don't want to act like I'm getting hate mail or hate tweets.
No, but like bad news in an email, you know.
Yes, anything. But yeah. More times than not, most people reach out because they want something. Very, very rare does someone reach out unsolicited with an email to say, Alan, I've got something that I want to give you. Or even, Alan, I just want to give you a compliment. Most of the time, it's they want something. And that's okay. I'm a servant leader. I'm here to provide that. However, it can drain you when everybody's always coming at you and grabbing at you and wanting something. And that's why, you know, I have such empathy for these professional athletes. I mean, if a few people a day are asking something from me, can you imagine how many people a day are asking something from Kevin Durant? Yeah. I mean, it's got to be hundreds every minute people asking.
I think that's one reason why he opted not to play here. Obviously, he'd rather go out and get a championship with Golden State, but playing in your home city
makes it that much harder.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that.
And these guys have people coming at them every second of every day that want something, and it's draining because if you learn to say no, which is really important, that's probably the best skill set that I've adopted in the past year and a half is the ability to say no. I'm a people pleaser. I like to say yes. It feels good to say yes. I often used to feel guilted into saying yes, but it finally dawned on me that when you say yes to something or someone, you're saying no to someone or something else, which, for example, if I say yes to going out with somebody on one night, I might be saying no to spending time with my children. So once I was able to look at it that way, and then I felt better about saying no confidently, because in theory, I was actually saying yes to something else that was more important. And you have to guard your time.
What's the key of saying no and not make enemies? Or does it even matter?
No, it does matter. I mean, I want to make sure that I treat everybody with respect. Yeah. So I'm firm and I don't use soft language. I don't make up excuses and I don't lie. If you ask me to do something on a Monday night, I'm not going to tell you I can't do it if I can. Now I'll say I won't do it.
Are we talking about hanging
reason.
Out or are we talking
it,
about,
it could be anything.
Hey, can you speak at this engagement? I need
let's just keep it business. Let's just say, can you speak at this engagement? And if I don't feel that that's a good opportunity for me or what I'm trying to do, then I'll just say, thank you so much, you know, for asking. I appreciate the offer. This is not a good fit for me at present, but I absolutely wish you the best. Or my schedule is completely full at the moment. I'm not going to be able to make this work, but I wish you the best. Thank you for reaching out. So, and that's how I handle it. And 99 times out of 100, people appreciate you being direct, being honest, and getting back to them. As you and I know firsthand, there's nothing worse than someone that doesn't get back to you at all and just leaves you hanging. So I always believe in responding, and I do it with honesty.
It's good. Going back to Gary, how did that interview happen? Did you reach out to him?
Actually, go back to relationships. There's a gentleman here that works with Monumental, Dan Shanoff, who's a friend of mine. Our kids go to the same school, and he used to work for the Washington Post. And when he worked for the Washington Post, he met Gary and his brother AJ during something that they were doing, and had always stayed in touch with them. And I was reaching out to Gary on social media. He had saw that because he had followed both of us, and he sent me a text and said, are you trying to get in touch with Gary? Because I think I have his ear if you are. I said, absolutely. Dan sent him an email that just said, I've got this guy that would like to interview you. And Gary was phenomenal about it. He put me in touch with his assistant, and 3 months later, I was in his office in New York, and we were recording a podcast.
What did you learn from that interview? He can be very game-changing.
He's remarkable. Yeah. What I learned is he's incredibly real and authentic, that he was exactly the same in that interview and in his office as he is on social media. There was nothing different. I mean, he is who he is. He's extremely present. I mean, we only had 30 minutes, which I respected. I mean, he's got a full plate, but that 30 minutes, he never looked at his watch once. He made great eye contact. He was dialed in. You would have thought he and I were friends for a decade with the attention that he gave. He didn't give blanket cookie cutter answers. Everything I was asking him, he was very specific about and was very involved in it. And the moment the clock struck at the 30-minute mark, then he left and he moved on, which was fine. But I was amazed at how present he was. And because there's plenty of people way more important than me that he could have been spending his 30 minutes with. So the fact that he, you know, invested 30 minutes with me and stayed present and at the very least acted like he cared was really awesome. And I appreciated that.
How would you speak to some people would call that curt. You have 30 minutes, go through my, you know, assistant at the, you know, at the, when that big hand hits, you know, 12, we're done. How would you speak to that?
I respected it. Yeah. Now, I'm assuming 10 years ago that wouldn't have been the case because he would have been in less demand. 10 years ago, he might have said, hey, come up, we'll spend the afternoon together. Let's talk and then we'll go out to eat. excuse me, but now he's in such demand, he can't do that. In fact, it was pretty funny. The moment we were done and he stepped right out of his office, I heard him yell to his assistant, "Okay, what do I have now?" Like, he didn't even know what the next 30 minutes were going to entail. That's how scheduled he is. And yeah. To give you a hint, when I reached out to his assistant and said, "I would love to have 30 minutes with Gary. When can we do that?" His assistant looked at the schedule and said, "The next time he has an open 30-minute block is 3 months from now. Do you want it?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely. I'll take it." I didn't even know what I was going to have on that day, but I knew that I'd take it. And
move it,
yeah, I respect that. And, you know, I'm a far cry from being to Gary V's level, but I'm getting to a point now where my schedule fills up quicker, and I'm never to the point where I'm going to say, "All right, Tom, we have to end this podcast in 8 minutes because I got to go somewhere else." But I could see 10 years from now, when my kids are older, I've got more things going on from a business standpoint, that I might need to protect my time to that degree. But that's also how Gary functions, and that's how he's a mover and shaker, and he wants to get in as much purposeful work in a given day as possible. So, you know, he has to guard his time, because you know me, I'm a talker. Well, yeah, if I went in and sat in his office and he just let me talk until I was finished talking, I'd eat up his entire afternoon, and that's not fair to him. So
he said,
I loved it.
He said, in a way, it's that saying no. It's like he said yes to you and gave you that time, but no of, "I can't be here all day."
And I respect it. Let me tell you a similar story. Yeah. Long story short, I tracked down Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavs, and went down to interview him. And I think to protect himself, because we had never met before, he had said something very similar. "You can come in to my office at Airlines Arena. We'll record for about an hour and then we'll move on."
Yeah.
Well, my team and I, we sat there for about 3 hours, just kind of shooting the stuff with him.
Did
I think
really?
Once we got there and he liked our vibe, he enjoyed the conversation. I think he had his morning blocked off, but he had it protected just in case.
Yeah.
In case there wasn't good energy or good flow, he could have cut it off, and he so that was kind of cool. So we got to spend, you know, a few hours with Mark Cuban, and I thought that was neat. But he definitely put the ending time. You have 1 hour to do this interview, and then he just kind of open-ended it and let us keep flowing.
So both Gary and Mark are brilliant in business and other things, but how are they similar, and then how are they different?
But what makes them brilliant is both of those guys are committed to the basics. I mean, they've made their fortunes and built their companies on basic principles. Neither one of them are magicians. Neither one of them, that's to me, that everything that those two guys are doing, all of us are capable of doing, but very few people do. So I don't say that to diminish them. I say that as the best compliment I could ever get someone, is they're willing to do the basics. And I love that.
Consistently doing
consistently.
I don't want to say easy things, but the basics.
The basic, fundamentals. Yes, not the easy things, the basic things. And both of them are practitioners. Both of them, I mean, they're in the trenches and they're still doing everything that they need to do. You know, both of them are in a financial position right now where they could put their feet up on their desk and pass the buck and have everybody else run their enterprise. Neither one of them does. Both of them are committed to that. The other similarities, they both want to be the most intelligent person in the room on a specific topic. So they study and research everything that they need to know, that if they're going to sit down with you, they know everything there is to know about that deal or about your company or whatever they need to know in order to have that advantage. They're both extremely confident, and that confident comes through demonstrated performance, you know, and they believe in themselves. Their self-belief and their self-awareness is off the charts.
How are they different?
How are they different? You know, I don't really know either one of them on a personal level. Yeah. I wouldn't want to pretend that I did. I definitely see more similarities than differences with both of them. You know, Mark's a little bit older and is, you know, bought and sold billion-dollar companies. So he has some different experiences than I think Gary does. That's a good question. I don't know how I'd say they're the most different.
Let me throw in one more guy.
Please.
You just spent some time, you spent some with Jesse
Itzler. Yes.
Tell me about that.
One of my favorite people. And Jesse Itzler is a serial entrepreneur who can definitely be thrown in this conversation with these other two titans. But even more so, his wife is Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. Yeah. So, you know, and I say this kind of tongue in cheek. I mean, Jesse's bought and sold million-dollar companies. I mean, his net worth is in the hundreds of millions. And his wife is a billionaire with a B. In fact, she's the youngest self-made female billionaire in the world. That is absolutely incredible. And both of them are absolutely brilliant. And they're both down to earth. They're very authentic, genuine, generous, caring people. They have a wonderfully connected, loving marriage between each other. They're very present for their four children. I've gotten to know them a little bit better on a personal level than either Gary or Mark, and I have nothing but admiration. So if I'm going to rewind, there was a friend of mine that I was training here in the DC area, but this was back in the Eats days, to do one of Coach K's fantasy camps. Mm-hmm. And this is where adults pay a lot of money to go play basketball and be coached by basketball legends. And he took it very serious. And while I was training him, he said, you know, there's this guy, his name's Jesse Itzler, but he goes by the name Jesse James. He's a rapper. He lives up in New York. But he's a great guy. He's very eclectic. He's extremely innovative. He's just brilliant in so many ways. He's like, Alan, you got to meet this guy. This was 10 years ago. And so I just kind of remembered, okay, there's a white guy who's a rapper. He goes by Jesse James. You're not going to forget that. And then over the years, because of basketball, Jesse's a big basketball aficionado, I kept bumping into other people that would bring his name up. And every time, the description and accolades were identical. He's innovative. He's eclectic. He's brilliant. He's fun. He's so generous. He's nice. He's self-aware. And I'm like, okay, when 9 or 10 people that I've met that I trust all give the same endorsement of this guy, I'm like, I have to meet him. So about a year ago, I started hitting him up on social media saying, hey, I'm leaving the basketball space and I'm doing more corporate work. If any of the businesses that you work with, you know, he's an owner of the Hawks, mm-hmm. any of the things you're doing, if you ever need a speaker, I'd love to be considered. And he was always very kind and would write back and just say, hey, I don't have anything for you, but thank you for reaching out. And then earlier this summer, I got an unsolicited email from him that said, I'm holding a retreat up at my house in New Fairfield, Connecticut, and I'm looking for a speaker. I think you'd be a great fit. Would you like to do it? Yes. Let me think about that. Okay, yes, I'll be there. And I went up and spoke at his retreat, and that was my first time meeting him. And
is this the one where you had to run up the hill?
That was the weekend after.
Okay.
Yeah. So this retreat, 30 people paid pretty high dollar to come spend an intense weekend with Jesse, and it was about emotional intelligence, physical fitness. I mean, it was remarkable. But that was my first time meeting him and seeing him in action. Yeah. And you know, I'll be darned if every single accolade that someone had given him wasn't true. I mean, he was as good a guy as I've ever met. And it was phenomenal. And then the next week is when he held this event called Hell on the Hill in the same place. So I got to spend time with him back-to-back weekends. And so it was incredible.
Go back a bit. You sure. reached out to him via social media, like a
yes.
message or something?
Twitter.
Or like
yes.
an opened...
No, like I at message him at Twitter, and I think I may have sent him a DM because I think he follows a lot of people. So I think once I had reached out to him, he just started following me. So I sent him a DM, and yeah, he was always very cool about getting back.
So go into... being consistently knocking on someone's door when did you did he gave you the no originally
mm-hmm.
did you
feel a couple like, times
a couple times mm-hmm. so I deal with, you know, in business you're reaching out for, you know, to do business with people mm-hmm. and you get a no or not even a no, but you don't hear back. And oftentimes people quit. They don't want to be annoying. They don't want to ruin a possible, you know, link later. But it actually worked out for your favor. You kept doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, describe that to me.
And I've done that so many times in my life. And I like to believe that I'm respectably persistent. You know, if some people want to say that that's annoying or you're a pest. And it's funny because sometimes I will preface that in my message. I hope I'm not annoying you. Just know that I'm relentless in my persistence of going after things that I want. I hope that's something you admire. And most of the people
out there like that.
Absolutely. And I feel that those guys are straight shooters. If I am being annoying, he'll simply write back, look, I don't have any need for you. If I do, I'll reach out to you. Don't contact me again. And if someone were to be that curt with me, then I would never bother them again because I do believe in being very respectful. More times than not, they appreciate the persistence. More times than not, the message I get back is, man, I love your hustle. I love your persistence. I don't have anything for you now, but thanks for staying in touch. All the best. And that happens all the time.
Down the road.
Absolutely. When I think it's appropriate. And so I had reached out to him a couple times and it was fine. And in this case, it worked because my goal with reaching out, one is I just want to serve them. I'm not trying to get anything from them. I'm looking for an opportunity where I might be able to fill a need that they have. Yeah. So it would be a win-win if they say yes. I wasn't reaching out to him saying, I want something or can you do something for me? It's if you have an opportunity where I could add value to an event, I'd hope you'd consider me. And I don't feel bad about doing that because it comes from a place of service. And in this case, it worked. And when he reached back out, I mean, yeah, you should have seen my face when I opened that email. Arguably the best email I've ever received.
So the way I look at it is if you are being consistent or persistent and consistent, and they react in a negative fashion, they probably weren't going to work with you anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm polite in all my dealings. So none of it, I'm not trying to guilt them into anything. I'm not trying to act like they owe me because they most certainly don't. Yeah. It's literally, I think, and I know sometimes it's hard to tell someone's tone via written communication.
Right. That's hard.
But I do think that they get the feel that this guy's just trying to help and be an asset and he's hustling. And most of the people I'm reaching out to, they went through their time where they were hustling like crazy as well. So I think they have a respect for it and it comes appreciated. And I know lots of people that, you know, I'll reach out to them. I don't hear back. I reach out again. Don't hear back. I reach out one more time and they end up thanking me. They end up saying, thanks for staying on me, man. I know I didn't return your last couple of emails. That's my bad. Thanks for your persistence. And it shows people that you care.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
And caring matters. So show.
Well, the key is also you're not going in. I mean, you are going and asking for something, but it's packaged in service because that's the backbone.
I'm asking to fill a need for you. Yeah. Now, yeah. And I think that's really important.
Cool. All right. So stronger team, kind of zigzag around here. Mm-hmm. Pure Sweat. Tell me how that happened.
After several years of running Pure Sweat, of Stronger Team, almost a decade, I was ready to move into something else. And I'd become really good friends with Drew Hanlon, who had started Pure Sweat Basketball several years before.
Which is skill-based.
He was skill-based. And he and I had tremendous alignment. We believe the same things. We run businesses in very similar ways. I had done many things with him. And I was just at a point where I felt being a smaller part of Pure Sweat would have a bigger impact on the basketball world than just being Stronger Team. That me being, to team up with him, we could reach more players and coaches and do more good than me doing my own thing in my own little silo. So
was that hard to give up the brand of Stronger
Team? It wasn't too bad. No, I was fine with it. I just had felt that it was time and I was ready to be a part of something bigger than myself, which I was very glad that I did. And again, we were in perfect alignment. It wasn't any way, shape, or form trying to take a round hole and shove it in a square peg. It was everything he's doing and working on, I can actually be an asset to that and raise the whole thing even higher. And, it made sense and was a great decision.
So then you're doing stuff with them now,
mm-hmm.
But you're also kind of shifting or pivoting into more of the corporate world. Tell me about that.
That's where most of my focus is now. So I'm not doing very many in-person basketball events. Most of the stuff I do for basketball now, my contributions are digital. We have a podcast, the Pure Sweat Basketball Show. I produce video content, mm-hmm. some social content, but not doing much in the way of speaking at clinics anymore because of what you just mentioned. My new focus is in the corporate sector and teaching CEOs and leaders and managers and different businesses how to create the same types of winning cultures and team cohesion and leadership strategies that the best basketball players and teams in the world use.
So it's using the lessons that you learned on the court and then applying them to real life corporate world.
Yes. I mean, as we said, I've been very fortunate that I've been able to be a fly on the wall around really good players and really good coaches. And I've learned a tremendous amount from them on leadership and teamwork and building habits and performance. And I want to take that, create and curate that content and share it with the rest of the world. Because I believe with every ounce of my being that the principles of achievement in basketball are identical to the principles of achievement in business without question. Now, some of the nuances obviously are going to be a little bit different. But as far as getting people to unite around their identity and creating standards and holding each other accountable using culture to drive results is the exact same.
Are the people that you're telling these things to, is it kind of eye-opening in the sense that it was right in front of them? I don't want to say right in front of them all the time, but it's stuff that they now can wrap their head around with the package of sports.
It's varying degrees. Yeah. Some people have always known it and they need an outside voice to come in and put the stamp on something they've already been saying. And we know how powerful an outside voice can be, especially from a perceived expert. Others of it never really dawned on them that those things would be the same. I am finding that the message resonates really, really well and that most people, not all, have some attachment to sports. Either they played when they were younger or they're a sports fan now, but at the very least, even if they're not a diehard sports fan, they respect what athletes do. I mean, you don't have to know anything about football. You have to respect what a Tom Brady does just from a preparation standpoint. I mean, you can hate the Patriots all you want, but you can't, I mean, you have to respect it. You have to respect what a Coach K has built at Duke. You have to respect what a Stephen Curry is doing with Golden State just from a preparation standpoint. So for me to kind of be the eyes and ears to translate the things I've learned from those type of people into the business world is usually very refreshing for them.
What are some of the key points that you discuss of success?
The number one are it's the habits you have during the unseen hours that, you know, if you're a basketball player, if we were to flip on TNT tonight and watch an NBA game and we watch Stephen Curry do something for 2 hours, what did he do for the hours leading up to that game or to the week leading up to that game? Or in his case, what's he been doing for the last 25 years of his life to prepare to perform in this game? That's the secret sauce. That's the stuff that makes him great. And same thing from a business standpoint. I mean, when you're sitting there in a meeting trying to close a deal, what you're doing there is just a result of everything that you've done beforehand. It's a cumulative effect. It's all the preparation that you've put in. So whether or not you get that deal, only a small portion hinges on what you're doing in the present. A good portion of it deals with the preparation that led up to that. And getting your people to understand in your business that they need to work to become the best versions of themselves in order to best serve the team is extremely important. So you need people that have good habits, that are happy in their home life, that are contributing in other areas, not just business. So I'm looking to raise the level of people as a whole, not just compartmentalize it and saying, we need you to sell more widgets.
What about the consistency? That word has come up a lot in this conversation. What role does consistency have?
To be successful in anything, you have to work hard, you have to work smart, and you have to do both consistently. Here's the thing though, you have to have all three. Two out of three won't do it. If you just work hard and smart, but you rarely do it, you won't be successful. If you work really hard and you do it all of the time, but you don't do it very wisely, you won't be successful. And it should go without saying that if you don't put any effort in, doesn't matter how consistent or smart you are, you're not going to get what you want. So consistency is crucial. And to me, that's arguably the most impressive trait. Anybody can be great for a day. A lot of people can be great for a week or a month. Some people can even be good for a year. But to be excellent consistently, year after year after year, is remarkable. And that's why you take a Kobe Bryant. I mean, the fact that he was able to do that for almost 20 years at that level is absolutely remarkable. And it goes back to consistency.
So I look at a consistency killer is procrastination. Mm-hmm. How do you avoid procrastination? Is it a matter of just saying, I'm just going to do it? Or is there a process or...
And let me say in full transparency that even though this is stuff that I teach, this is stuff that I share, I have the same struggles and challenges of those that I'm talking to. And I say that with full humility and transparency because I never, ever want any group that I speak with to think that I've got this figured out because I don't. Procrastination is one of my own Achilles heels that for whatever reason, and I don't know if this is me just self-rationalizing it, I do my best work when there's a deadline, when there's something pressing, which is the old wait and cram the night before to study for a test. Now, I'm better at it in some areas. I'm not waiting to prepare for a speech the night before, per se, but I tend to do better, and it helps me prioritize. So I do have a bad habit of, you know, I have an hour block today where I could be working on that, and I'll end up filling that hour with things that might be less important. But at the end of the day, I'm very deadline-driven. I do get everything done when it needs to be done to the best of my ability. But procrastination is definitely an enemy of consistency, and it's something that I struggle with.
How do you snap back into the routine or, you know, to get back on track?
From a procrastination standpoint, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I don't ever really fall off of a routine. I've got a running to-do list and an action item list that I check in every morning and every night. And
so you do it both in the morning and night?
I do, yeah. I do. I mean, the morning is when, okay, what am I going to accomplish today? What am I going to go after? And the night is, it's kind of a review of what I got done and plant that subconscious seed of what am I going to have to wake up and hit the ground running doing tomorrow.
All right. So what is your morning routine?
I'm a fairly early riser by nature, always have been. Now, come 10 o'clock at night, I'm not worth very much. So I know there's folks that are morning people and those that are night owls. I'm definitely more of a morning person. And the reason that's important is I've learned through self-awareness that I do my best work in the morning. That's okay. When my best thoughts arise. That's when I'm most productive, when I'm most efficient. But I know people that are the exact opposite. They do better working at 2 or 3 in the morning on the tail end of their day, whereas I do better working at 5, 6, or 7 in the morning to start my day. So there is no right answer. The key is finding what works best for you. So for me, if I'm putting myself to bed at 10, waking up at 5:30 or 6 is no problem. I mean, I'm getting my 8 hours sleep. I feel refreshed. I'm ready to go. I very rarely set an alarm anymore. The
really?
Only time I set an alarm is if I need to catch a flight before 8 a.m. That's the only, and that's just to make sure I don't miss it. Other than that, my body just naturally wakes up 6:30, 7 o'clock.
So what do you do when you wake up?
Very first thing I do, and this is as of the time of this recording, the last 113 straight days, I've meditated using the Headspace guided meditation app. And the only reason I can say that with such specificity is it tracks how many days you've done it in a row. So this morning was literally number 113 straight days. It's a 10-minute guided meditation app. It just helps me collect my thoughts and clear my thoughts and become more mindful. So literally, while I'm still laying in bed, the moment I wake up, I don't look at anything else on my phone except for the Headspace app, and I do that for 10 minutes.
What does that do for you?
It just helps center me. It just helps kind of start my day at peace. So instead of looking on Twitter and seeing something that could irritate me, I follow something
fall down the rabbit hole.
Yes. It actually does the exact opposite. It gives me some inner peace. It helps me become more mindful. Now, there's also an app called Blinkist. And I don't know if you've heard of Blinkist. It basically, every book that's ever been written, they have a 10-minute summary on that book. It's like
really?
A Cliff Notes, and you can either listen to it or you can read it. And now I'm a voracious reader, and I believe in reading full books, but I like using it because it gives me a taste of a book. So for me, if I listen to a Blinkist summary, 10 minutes, then I decide, do I want to buy the book and read the whole thing? Or maybe this wasn't a good fit, but it gives you the best 10 minutes from the book. It is an app.
Okay.
Yeah. And I love it. So depending on what I have scheduled for the day, lots of times I go right from meditation to listening to a book. So that means 20 minutes, I'm still laying in bed. Now, I don't mean laying in bed because I can't get out. I mean laying in bed because I want to focus on these two things before I even step out of my bed. And I try to listen to Blinkist before I go to bed as well. But it's just 10 minutes, and it's great. It's fuel for my mind.
Yeah.
It's a great way to educate myself. Then I get up. I'm a big bed maker. So I make my bed every single morning. And then it just depends. On a day where I'm working out, I try to get my workout in first thing before I do anything else. And that's probably 3 days a week.
Okay.
The other 3 days, I'll go into my office at home and start to do some purposeful work. So maybe it's some type of writing. Maybe it's, anything other than social media and email is what I try to focus on for the first little bit. Then after that, eat breakfast or what have you, and then check email and social media and just see what's going on with the rest of the world. But by that point, I've already laid a solid foundation.
Your mindset's done, yeah.
My mindset's fine. So that way I'm better prepared that if there is some negative energy coming in via social or email, I can handle it much better. And
what's the deal with making your bed?
I've done that every single day for the past 25 or 26 years. Now, it's funny. There was a book, and I want to say, I believe I was in college. It might have been right out of college. It was called The Millionaire Mindset. And there was somebody that interviewed, say, 1,000 self-made millionaires in the United States. And the self-made is key. That these were your everyday folks. These were not famous people. These were not rock stars and magicians. Musicians.
Or magicians.
Either way, it wasn't David Blaine. and they did an interview, and they wanted to find some of the commonalities among the wealthy.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because in my mind at that time, in my 20s, I would picture millionaires driving Lamborghinis and Ferraris. They said the average car that a millionaire drove was a Toyota Camry. Because
really?
It was practical, it got good gas mileage and so forth. I mean, it was amazing. But it said something to the degree of 97%, something along those lines, 97% of self-made millionaires make their bed every single morning, which again, I'm thinking, and I know the word millionaire means different things to different people, but I'm thinking, man, if you're a millionaire, you probably have a maid, you have somebody that makes your bed for you. So I was shocked by that. So my simpleton mind at that point thought, well, if 97% of self-made millionaires make their bed, I'll start making my bed and then I'll become a self-made millionaire. I didn't realize it wasn't cause and effect, that it was more just that's just a principle that they lived by. But, what it does for me is it's a great way to start my day with an act of discipline. And I believe discipline is crucial to being successful. And it's simple. I'm a big routines and consistency guy. So if I can start every day with an act of discipline, and I'm making my bed before a lot of people even get out of their own bed, I feel that it gives me a competitive advantage. And it's really simple. And I'm so programmed to do it now. I mean, I make my bed when I'm staying at hotels, knowing darn well. Really? So, absolutely. It's a habit now. Yeah. It's an unbreakable habit. I've done it every day for the past 25, 26 years. It is unbreakable. There are times where I have to wake up at 3 a.m. to catch a 6 a.m. flight. I don't even remember making my bed. I get home a couple days later and that thing is made. It's perfect. Military corners, the whole nine. I don't even remember doing it. That's how strong of a habit it is.
Who taught you how to make a bed?
I think I just figured it out. Yeah. This was pre-YouTube, so I didn't have a YouTube video to teach me how to make a bed.
You know, it's funny. We can log on right now. There's probably videos about how to make beds.
Oh, there absolutely 100%. Is. Yeah.
Mental toughness. You've mentioned that before. Describe what that means.
I believe mental toughness is your ability to stay in the present moment, which is really challenging to do. It's able to block out all of the distractions and minutiae that's going on and stay in the present moment. It's not being, you know, consumed by what the past has gone on, and it's not being worried about the future. It's being in the present moment, and it is really challenging to do. But I think that is true mental toughness.
How does that correlate between sports and the, you know, life?
The only way you can be the best, no matter what you're trying to do, whether you're trying to make a free throw or you're trying to parent your child, the only way you can be at your best is to be into the moment, is to own the moment, as a friend of mine, Carl Lentz, says, and he just wrote a book about it, is to be in the present moment.
So what does that mean? People say that a lot.
So, well, first of all, you can't live in the past. Right. The past is over. There's nothing to do about it. Now, you can learn from the past, as we all should, but yesterday's newspaper's already been printed. You can't change anything. So the more mental energy and emotional energy you expend focused on something that's unchangeable is not in your best interest. Most people spend a lot of time worrying about the future. What's going to happen tomorrow? What's going to happen next week? What's going to happen a year from now? And again, that serves them no purpose. One, tomorrow's not guaranteed. Mm. And I say that, you know, with tremendous empathy with all the crazy things that are going on in the world right now. I mean, think the most recent, unfortunately, of the catastrophic events at the time of this recording was the shooting in Texas in the church. 26 people passed away. Not one of those people woke up that morning and said, today is going to be the last day of my life. Yeah. Not one of them. Not one of them. And if today ends up being the last day of my life, I'm not feeling that right now, because you have to be in the present moment. But that just shows you that tomorrow is not guaranteed. So why worry about something that you're not even promised? Now, prepare for the future.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying live recklessly, and it ain't YOLO. I'm just saying to make sure that you spend most of your time focused on the present moment, because that's really what we have.
Go back to letting the past be the past. People find that difficult, whether it's guilt, whether it's regret, whether what, you know, it's hard sometimes.
And back to that transparency, this living present is something I still struggle with. Yeah. It's a challenge. I don't play golf, but from my friends that play golf, they tell me that it's a sport you can never master.
Oh my gosh, no.
Yeah, you just can't master it. Well, it's the same thing about living present. There, you know, you could go and find a monk somewhere. He's not present every second of every day. Now, he's probably more present than I am, and I may be more present than a lot of people, but it's not something you can master. So I'm finally at a point in my life where I have heightened self-awareness that I know when I'm not being present. And when I know that I'm not being present, I have a trigger to myself to get myself back in the moment, and that's be where your feet are. Wherever your feet are, that's where your head and your heart should be as well. So when you're with your kids, be with your kids. When you're in a business meeting, be in the business meeting. You know, be fully present with everything that you're doing. And, you know, I think the phones can be a major distraction. I can tell you honestly how many times I've been with my kids, but I'm not really with my kids. I'm solely focused on what's going on my phone, and I'm not with them. I might be with them in body, but I'm not with them in mind and spirit. And that's a problem, which means there's no way that I'm creating a connection with them or that I'm parenting them to the best of my ability if my attention is elsewhere.
Being present, especially with your kids, does that offset the times that you are traveling and working? Does it help offset those times?
Helps tremendously, yeah. And that's why I no longer worry about the quantity of time. It's more of the quality of time. That even if I only have my kids for an hour, as long as I'm fully connected with them and fully present, you can pack a pretty good punch in that hour. And kids are very intuitive. I mean, your kids know when you're not paying attention to them. I mean, just think how many times either yourself or you've seen someone, you're looking at your phone, hey, daddy, watch this. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that's really good. Uh-huh. oh yeah, that's really great, buddy. Good job. Yeah. You're not paying any, they know that.
Yeah.
And if the people that you care about the most, you can't be present with, that's a problem. And again, I don't say this with any tone of being condescending because it's something I still struggle with. Now, where I can say with great pride is I'm better today than I was a year ago. And I plan to be better a year from now than I am today, but it's something that's really tough to master. But being present means a few things. One, it means you only focus on the next play, whatever's going to happen next. I say next play because of the basketball analogy, but what's next? And that's what's most important. Focusing on the next play, you need to focus on the only two things in the world that you can control, which is your attitude and your effort. As soon as you start worrying about anything outside of those two things, many times it's wasted energy.
Why do we do that?
Lack of mental toughness.
Is that what, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we forget. I mean, for me, anytime any area of my life starts to go off the rails, professionally or personally, it's because I'm usually focused on something outside of my own attitude and effort. I'm worried about what you're doing or what you're not doing. I'm worried about, you just can't do that. And then the last portion of living present is focusing on the process. Don't worry about the outcome. Focus on the process. What are the steps needed to do what you're trying to do?
All right. So in this path of success, what is that? Is there a pattern? What's the pattern? Is there steps to the pattern?
As far as the process?
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with having an outcome or a desired result or a goal, but then you need to work backwards and reverse engineer that and figure out what are the daily tasks that need to be done to make that happen.
Dream backward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you have a goal a year from now, whatever it may be. Maybe it's to take a trip. Maybe it's to make X amount of money. And then you figure, okay, well, what do I need to do each quarter to make that happen?
Yeah.
What do I need to do each month to make that happen? Each week and each day. And then it'll take you back to the present moment. Because ultimately what you'd say is, what do I need to do right now that will take me a little bit closer to whatever it is that I'm trying to get? Because that's the only one you can worry about, is right now. And the analogy I use all the time is the way you build a brick wall is brick by brick. Hmm. You don't have to worry about what the wall is going to end up looking like. All you have to worry about is setting that one brick exactly where it needs to go. And as soon as you set that one brick down, now find another brick, set it exactly where it needs to go. And if you do that consistently, ultimately you'll have a brick wall.
Sounds like consistency is the secret. I mean, you could apply that to weight loss. You know, I want to lose 20 pounds, but you know what? I can't do anything about the 20 pounds, but I can do something about what I put in my body today.
Yes,
and if
exactly.
You really think about today and being in the moment.
And what can you do right now that will help you with losing that 20 pounds? So right now, maybe you could go for a walk. Right now, you can make a better educated decision on what you're going to eat for lunch. Because you can't, until you lose pound one, you can't lose pound 2 through 20.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to focus on the one that's directly in front of you. And I find lots of times that intimidates people. Like losing 20 pounds, that's tough. That's a lot of work.
It's also immediate gratification.
Yes.
We all want it now. We want the fixes now.
Yes.
Dr. Brian Paris, who's
a good friend of ours.
Yeah. I went in there for some back pain one time, neck pain. And he put me in this contraption, and I was like, how long, you know, I want it fixed today.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and goes, listen, man, it took you 15 years to get to this point. It's not going to be fixed today. It's,
right.
You know, not to say that it's going to take 15 years to be fixed, but it's a good life lesson.
Yeah. Just focus on what's right in front of you.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say this the other day at a conference I was attending. He said, you know how you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
think
an
about
Navy
that.
SEAL mantra.
Oh, yeah. I love that. There's a lot of truth to that.
Let me ask you this. What's been your... favorite failure that led to a breakthrough?
Favorite failure. There was a time when I was at Montrose Christian and Gary Williams was still the head basketball coach at University of Maryland, and they were looking for a basketball strength and conditioning coach. And he had come and recruited around Montrose, so I'd gotten to know him, and it looked like I was going to be a good fit for that gig. And I was really, really excited. I mean, to be in the ACC, to be a part of Maryland, that was big. And while they were trying to work some things out logistically, I just said, look, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go ahead and start working with the team now. And I started working with them for about 3 weeks. And ultimately, they couldn't make it work. There was an issue with compliance based on my relationships with certain high school players. They couldn't make it work financially. So after 3 weeks of me basically volunteering my time and feeling like I was the performance coach for Maryland men's basketball, the rug got kind of pulled out underneath me to no fault of Coach Williams. He was very cool about it. He felt awful about it. I don't... I don't know if you'd consider that a failure because it wasn't anything from lack of my doing. I do remember that's one of the most disappointed times that I've ever been professionally, that I went for 3 weeks thinking I was the basketball performance coach for University of Maryland men's basketball. And then 3 weeks later, just like that, I wasn't.
So
it was really disappointing.
That, I would assume, allowed you to do the next chapter.
Oh, without question. Yeah. Anytime one door closes, some other doors will open if you're open to it. Yeah. And where I'm proud of that is I was resilient enough. I mean, I pouted for a couple of days. I was down in the dumps and definitely disappointed. And then I realized, okay, this is not going to change. So you can sit here and wallow in it, or you can just move on to the next thing. And I don't remember offhand what the next thing was, but you know, that was one experience that's put me literally where I'm sitting today. And I'm very pleased with where I'm sitting today.
I mean, you have to look at it that way.
Yeah.
I think everything happens for a reason.
Yes.
So that was meant not to happen so you could do yes. what you're doing today.
And I heard something the other day. There was a gentleman named Eckhart Tolle who's written a few books, and he was on one of Oprah's podcasts. And I love Oprah's Super Soul Sunday podcast. They're so enlightening. And he said something to the effect, and I'm sure I'm butchering it, but that you need to have the mindset. It's kind of like the everything happens for a reason, but everything that happens to you, you need to assume that it happened in your best interest, that even no matter how negative it is, that you need to reframe it and say, this happened because it's going to do something else for me. And just assume that every moment is happening in your best interest. Give it the benefit of the doubt. And I know that's really challenging, especially when something awful happens, catastrophic happens, a death or disease or something that, you know, has a major toll on us. But on some level, approach it as if that's exactly what is supposed to happen in my life right now to put me where I need to be. And that reframe can help.
You know, it's a tough pill to swallow, like losing a loved one, especially a child. But, you know, I use the example of John Walsh, who lost his son, Adam, all those years ago.
Yeah.
And if, quite honestly, if that hadn't happened, how many fugitives has he been involved in catching?
For sure.
Yeah. So as hard of a pill as that to swallow, you got to kind of force yourself to look at it that way and accept it.
Very much.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, who on this podcast, we like to have the guests pass the baton, pass the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Who is someone that you think our audience would like to hear their story and hear how they made waves in their lives and career?
I've got two. I've got one rather local in East Coast, and I've got one on the West Coast.
Okay.
The local one is Paul Rabel, who is kind of the LeBron James of lacrosse. He's, by many people, consider him the best lacrosse player on the planet. He went to DeMatha, which is where I was introduced to him at first. Just a remarkable guy. He's a big-time entrepreneur. He has a podcast now called Suiting Up with Paul Rabel. He's extremely intelligent in so many different areas. He's a phenomenal athlete. He's great with marketing and branding. He understands entrepreneurship, but he's a really positive, uplifting guy. And I'd be happy to make that introduction. So Paul Rabel. And then the other is on the West Coast is Dolvet Quintz, who was one of the trainers on The Biggest Loser and is a phenomenal guy. He did the 29-29 challenge that I did, this mountain climbing thing a few weeks ago with Jesse Itzler. And I had a chance to spend time with him. So he's big in fitness, big in the wellness space, brilliant guy, very high emotional IQ. He understands that helping people lose weight and getting in shape, that the physical is not what the problem is. It's the mental and emotional. And once he can break down those barriers, changing the physical is really simple.
Because anybody can do it.
Oh, it's without question. Yeah. And he's an expert at getting people to break down those barriers to do that. So, you know, and that's funny because on the surface, someone would say, well, let me go watch Dolvet's workouts and see what exercises he does and how many sets and how many reps. And when I can do that, then I can get my... No, what he's doing is between the ears. It's the mental and emotional that he does. So both of those guys, I'd be happy to make an introduction to you. And they're really, really good guys that have an amazing message and amazing journey.
Well, thank you. Where can everyone find you on social media?
At Alan Stein Jr. And that's the same as the website, allensteinjr.com. Yeah. I've
Were
got
you
everything
lucky
linked
enough
up.
To get that on?
I was very fortunate. Yeah. Yeah. Very lucky. So, and that's where they can find out what I've got going on. But, you know, more importantly, if they like some of the stuff that I've shared here, I put out this type of content on a pretty regular basis. And, okay. I do it because I want it to serve people.
And we have any business owners that need keynote speakers, how do they get a hold of you?
Same thing. You can fill out an inquiry at allensteinjr.com. Definitely reference that they found me on this podcast. That'd be kind of neat to hear about that. But yeah, I do. I mean, in addition to keynotes, I run workshops. So half-day workshops, do some consulting and some training. So, you know, executive coaching is what other people call it. So yeah, if there's anybody listening that I could serve, I'd be really honored to do it.
Well, listen, man, I appreciate you coming in. I appreciate the time. And I look forward to seeing you again.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we'll have to do this again.
Hope so.
We left out that last Jesse thing that you did.
Yes.
So next time we'll cover that.
Absolutely.
That mountain thing that was equivalent to climbing what mountain?
Mount Everest.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And you did that.
I did.
All right. We'll save that as a teaser.
Sounds good. I'll be back for sure.
Thanks, Al.
Well, that's a wrap, everybody. You can find all the relevant links right in the show notes. Check out Making Waves Podcast for more information. And to watch video versions of the podcast, find us on YouTube. Don't be a stranger. Reach out on social media. Let me know who you'd like to hear on the show, or just say hi. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, please tell someone you know and help spread the wave. Making Waves Podcast is produced by The Blue Wave, a media and production company and digital agency. That's thebluewave.net. So for now, thanks for listening, have a great day, and go make some waves.